here. We have a very packed agenda today, and one that's very important. And I know that there are a lot of people in this room. We have a lot of people who are coming in through streaming. But I really encourage supervisors to make sure that every staff member sees this this streamed video and this presentation. Is there a problem? It will not be available after. Okay. Well, I hope that you people who are distant drag everyone in close to a computer, because this is something that's important to us all. Safety is first. As you know, in this building we had a blackout recently, and we were not all entirely sure what to do. That won't happen in the future. We are in communication with security and health and safety, and we will have an evacuation procedure set up for every one of our libraries so that we know what to do under these circumstances, know what to do at different decision points, and that we know it automatically. So I'm very conscious of that. So I am going to, there are two announcements I want to make. That one is that we will have a specially called Dean's Corner on February the 11th, and that meeting will be devoted entirely to going over climate qual.
How? Is that the 7th or the live qual on the 7th?
Okay, the 7th. Okay, so it's February the 7th that the Dean's Corner is. That will be instructions and a full discussion on climate qual. Climate qual is the Association of Research Libraries instrument that we are encouraging all staff to fill out, which assesses climate within an organization. And as you recall, with the evaluations of the deans, this was on my to-do list to address essentially what we can do within this organization to make it a better place to work, and by doing that, to provide better service to our users. So we will be engaged in that. Lori will be going over with you the instructions for it. All supervisors need to understand that filling it out is work. It will take some time. People will have to have some time to think, and you'll have to give them staff members time to do it. So I encourage everyone to do that. It is totally confidential. We don't get raw data. We will not be able to tell who answered what. But that's an important meeting that I want everybody to address, to make sure that you put on your calendar and come to. Also, we will be celebrating Mardi Gras, our annual party, where we thank everybody and we have a great time, not on Tuesday, but on Monday. So, Mardi Gras on Monday, it will be a lot of fun. So put that on your calendars. And so without further ado, I would like to introduce Pierre Barbary, who is chief or head or honcho of security on campus, guru, whatever his name, whatever your title is. Anyway, he's a good guy. He's a very good guy, and I'll hand the podium over to him.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for the invitation, and thank you for coming today. What I'd like to do is talk to you a bit about the department, the unit, security services, and a little bit about university safety, and then go into a little more specifics on why we're all here today. I have to figure out what computer we're using. So as an agenda, I'd like to introduce to you security services, look at active shooter case studies, show you about a 15-minute training program video. Some of you might have seen it. Some of you have already attended one of these sessions. And then go over some protocols and procedures with respect to active shooter. Unfortunately, I'm here for this. I'd rather be here for other reasons, more positive reasons. But it's important for everyone to receive some training when it comes to active shooter situations. Okay. So who or what is security services? What do we do? We're here to protect persons and property. We're here to create a favorable atmosphere for academic pursuits. We liaise with police forces, federal, provincial, municipal, for various reasons. Municipal mostly for day-to-day operations and day-to-day investigations. Provincial and federal, a little more with the VIPs that we have, government officials that come on campus, etc. So we have great relationships with all three levels of law enforcement in the province and in our immediate vicinity here. We provide transportation for the physically challenged, so the big white bus that you see throughout campus, we're the ones that operate that, with obviously cooperation with the Office of Students with Disabilities. We're open 24 hours, 7 days a week, 365. Downtown campus, we moved about 6 months ago. We used to be at the Ferrier Building. We're now on the first floor of the Burnside Building. And on the first floor of Laird Hall at Mac Campus. A little synopsis of a little more precision on the organization. We have a hybrid approach at McGill Security Services where our management team and admin and support staff are McGill employees, and the uniform personnel that you see on campus are contracted out to an external contract agency. So our management team, what do? We have an operations unit that handles all the day activities, all special events, construction on campus, and I'm sure you've seen the construction on campus the last couple of years and construction that's coming up in the next several years. Supervised security agents. We have a systems technology team that handles all cameras and card readers and all that technology that's on campus. We have a unit just for that. We have an investigator, a full-time investigator, who also handles crime prevention and community relations. Chantal, who just left, who is back here, is a member of that team. And we have different initiatives that are on campus. We have the STOP program, which are, I don't think you have it here. We should have, yes, you do. Good. I'm impressed. Very nice. This is the STOP program. It's not a GPS type of system for laptops, but it's basically a deterrent. You can't remove this plate without about 500 pounds of pressure. And even if you remove this plate, it says stolen property underneath. So it's very hard to resell. Because when thefts of laptops occur, it's mostly for reselling purposes. A quick $50, $100 to be made. So that's why the thefts of laptops. So what we do is we encourage individuals to put this plate on their laptops for a minimal fee of $20. And it minimizes the chances of the laptop being stolen. We have NBCI training. We've been offering this training for about 8 years now. It's called Nonviolent Crisis Intervention Training. It's great for frontline staff, supervisors. It gives people techniques on how to handle difficult situations. We could call it verbal judo if you wish. And then in the afternoon, there's a little more physical intervention on giving you techniques on how to handle physical situations. We offer RAD training, which is Rape Aggression Defense training for women. It's a day and a half course that's offered to all women on campus. We have a welcome video that's on our website. We do various fundraising initiatives throughout the year for local charities. We have a lost and found department, and trust me, it's a huge lost and found department. I have one person just dealing with lost and found items, and it's just overwhelming. You can imagine we're in small city here with over 40,000 people. There's a lot of items that are lost, unfortunately. And then obviously we offer various training sessions, including this one, which is why you're here today. Our uniform personnel patrol the campus on foot, cars, and bicycles. Bicycles were instituted about a little over three years ago, I think. And we got really positive feedback with this initiative. And the reason why is it brings individuals, it feels like individuals could approach our patrollers even more. And it gets our patrollers closer to the community instead of patrolling their vehicles with, you know, windows up or whatnot. So it's a great initiative. It keeps our agents in shape also during the summer months. We have a relations patroller that was created about 3-4 years ago. His or her responsibility is relations with the community. The individual doesn't respond to calls unless there's a huge emergency. Person's role is really to go and visit various units and departments and just talk and just exchange and see what's going on in different units. We had a lag in the last 2 or 3 months When we lost our relations patroller, we just hired one starting within the next 2 weeks. So we're really happy for that, so that you'll start seeing an individual. I'll come and see you and just say hi. So don't worry about that. He's on the up and up. Respond to various incidents and emergencies on a daily basis. We provide safety escorts. I'm not sure if some of you know this, and I hope you do, but if you don't, that's what I'm here for. Safety escorts. If you work late at night, feel uncomfortable, you park your car a little further than usual, call us. We'll send a patroller over, walk you to your vehicle. We'll walk you to the nearest metro station. We offer that type of service. Student-run WalkSafe has that for students. We also supplement their needs if there's an influx of calls to them, or if there's less volunteers at a certain period of the year, example, during the exam period. So we'll get calls from students, for example, for safety escorts. Okay, so we do that for our community. We control access to various buildings, special events, frosh, convocation. Any event on campus that requires security, we handle that, and we'll have personnel on site. Construction safety, huge endeavor. In the last 3 years, we had an average of 35 to 40 agents a day extra just for construction safety. So, and this is ongoing. So it's a huge endeavor. It has been for the last couple of years. Our centralized security system, so basically with your access card, all the card readers you see on campus, we have about 850, 900 card readers right now on campus. Most of, or not, if not all of our buildings, the perimeter of our buildings are all secured by card reader. To manage access levels, staff and student ID cards. We video survey, we have cameras throughout campus. We monitor our alarm and we arrange for response protocols when it comes to our agents on how to respond to a specific alarm that comes in. I forgot to mention, please raise your hand and let me know if you have any questions. Well, you know, it's not a, don't want it to be a monologue. I'm going through it a little quicker because I know why you're here. It's to discuss active shooter situations. If there's one slide, and I hope there's more that you're going to remember, but if there's one slide that you're going to remember, please remember this one. In case of an accident or incident, call 911. Don't be scared to call 911 thinking, is my emergency serious enough to call 911? If you're asking yourself that, it is. So just call. What we ask you to do, though, is if you call 911 from a cell phone, call us immediately after. The reason why is we'll send somebody to the exact location. And then we'll send somebody to a one of our patrollers to a designated location to escort the emergency responders to your exact location. I'm sure you know that some of our civic addresses aren't the easiest to find. And I'll use, well, our former neighbors, because we used to be at the ferry. I always use the James Admin building, 845 Sherbrooke. Try to find the 845 Sherbrooke if you're driving along Sherbrooke Street. You won't. That's why we have protocols in place. So please call us immediately after. If you call 911 from a landline, we monitor the call at our control center, so you don't have to call us back. Okay, so again, we'll send somebody to the exact location and then have somebody escort the emergency responders. Okay? People ask me, do I have to dial 9 before I dial 911? Either way, it works. 9-911, 911 directly, it works. Various emergency phones on our campus. Exterior on yellow poles with blue lights, on buildings with blue lights, in elevators. Press that red button, goes directly to our control center. Again, we'll ask you what the emergency is, and we'll send somebody over. If you don't respond, we'll obviously send somebody over, because we know exactly what elevator, for example, is ringing at our control center. Okay. Okay, active shooter. Some case studies I want to talk to you about. Contrary to some belief, there's no standard profile when it comes to an active shooter. There's varied targets, and there have been multiple motivations. And out of the shootings that have occurred on campuses throughout North America and Europe, a third of the shootings killed over 10 people. So these are mass shooting incidents. I mentioned there's no standard profile, but there are warning signs. So I'm just going to put them up and then. And when I look at this, I look everyone around, you know, everybody's going through something, okay? That doesn't mean that you're going to become a shooter on a campus. It's just warning signs that we may see in individuals and a change of behavior that may want us to look at it a little deeper, okay? So the warning signs could be someone suffering from academic troubles, employment or financial issues, personal family troubles, suffering from isolation or rejection, asocial behavior, association with deviant subcultures, substance abuse, obsession with violence, music, video games, firearms. Again, it's not because somebody plays video games that they become a shooter. If they've been playing for an hour a day and now all of a sudden they're playing 8 hours, 9, 10 hours, or not getting out of their room, there's something there that we might want to consider. And I say we as parents, if they're obviously in their rooms, or in residences, if change of behavior is obvious, let's speak up. And I'll tell you why in a few seconds, why it's important to speak up. Identifiable factors that motivated or triggered the attack. A third of the shootings were related to some intimate relationship. Since 1955, 27% of the cases, shooters were themselves victims of bullying. Retaliations for specific actions. Person was just fired, for example. Refusals or advances or obsessions. Responses to academic stress or failure. Acquaintance, stranger sexual violence. Workplace dismissal, psychotic actions. Subject's need to kill, specific victimology. Blonde, 20 to 25, blue eyes. That's victimology. Draw attention to self or issue. That too you'll see in a few slides, what I mean by drawing attention. It's rarely an impulsive act. We hear about it, we wake up in the morning or during the day, boom, shooting at a university or college or whatnot or a workplace. It's not that the person woke up that day and said, yeah, I'm going to do this now. Studies have shown anywhere from 2 weeks to 2 years of preparation have gone into these shootings on campuses. Some shootings, however, occurred 48 hours following an incident. So that was their trigger, right? So a shooting occurred, 48 hours later, it's my time now. It's my limelight now. So some shootings have occurred after other shootings. Seeking 15 minutes of fame, literally, I'm going to show you this again in a few slides, what that means. 75% of the shooters verbalize their intention to do so. Let's listen. People say, oh, I'm going to shoot my boss. I hate my boss. I hate my teacher. I hate whatever. And it just flies over. 75% of these shooters told somebody they would do this. We need to speak up. Let's not hesitate to speak up. I'm going to show you a great case of somebody that did speak up and prevented a mass shooting. Some considerations. In context, the traveling attacker is a rare event. Only 3% of the shooters traveled to several buildings. Okay, so they get to one location, they do their mass harm, and that is it. It's very rare that they're going to go, I'll use an example here, from Burnside to then McConnell and then the FDA. It's very rare. Reason? They don't have the time. If they travel, I hate to say this, but they're wasting time on what they want to do, which is kill as many people as they can, as quickly as they can. Only 4% travel within the same building, so they don't go floor to floor. They look as much as possible where they're at to do what they need to do as quickly as possible. Some people might add, I mean, I put my my footnotes at the bottom on where I get my stats, and this is a long acronym, but for IACLEA, the International Association of Campus Law Enforcement Administrators. I'm the Canadian director and member of the board, and we met with the Secret Service about 2 years ago in Washington, and they provided us with the stats and allowed various institutions to present these stats to our local institutions. So just to let you know, these are stats that were gathered up through studies from the Secret Service over many, many years. Other considerations. Three-quarters of the attacks use firearms or knives. Other means, strangulation, arson, vehicle, blunt object. Put vehicle. There was an incident. Can't recall what state, and I always give this presentation, I always say that, and I never look it up. An individual drove his vehicle through glass window, and there were individuals obviously in the vicinity, and killed the individuals. He used his vehicle as his weapon. Obviously, though, as you can see, firearms are definitely the weapon of choice, if you wish. Other considerations, 20% of the incidents took place off campus or in non-campus locations against institution of higher ed members. So when I use this example here for us, for example, Solon Hall, it's definitely off campus, Atwater and Lionel Gou Metro Station. And so 20% of incidents have taken place actually off of main campuses. In many instances, the professor is the first one killed. Why? The authority figure and decision maker. Even though we might think it no longer exists at university level or college levels, students still look at the professor as the person to tell them what to do since elementary school. Even though it's hard to believe, in critical situations, they're looking at an individual to tell them what to do. The shooter knows that. This is why, unfortunately, the person at the front of the room, auditorium, or whatnot, is the first one to is the first target. This is a professor of engineering at Virginia Tech that was killed. It doesn't only happen elsewhere, right? We read about it in the States. We hear about it in the States, in Europe, and whatnot. It happens here. I'll give you a few slides. December 6, 1989, L'École Polytechnique, where Mac Lépine killed 14 women. There was one, I hate to say this, there was one positive out of this tragedy. The one positive, police response protocols changed after this. At the time, police were trained to answer to mass critical calls like this, create a perimeter, safeguard the perimeter, and wait for SWAT teams to arrive. That's what happened that night. Not blaming the police, I'm just saying, after this, police started training that first responder police officers are to get to the shooter as quickly as possible. Give me a perfect example in this slide. Two slides. Concordia University, Valerie Fabricant killed four individuals in 1992. Kim Vergil, 2006 at Dawson, killed one. This number is one too many, but we're lucky it was only one. Several factors. First of all, the way the police are trained to respond definitely helped. Secondly, lucky, because police officers were already on site for another call. That's why they were able to respond that quickly. Okay? So luck played a lot with it, but also how they responded to it minimized the tragedy. It doesn't only happen at colleges and universities. Harris and Klebold, 1999, Columbine killed 13. Actually, it took this tragedy for the police in the States to change their response protocols. See, we changed them after the Lépine tragedy, the incident at Polytechnique. 10 years later, the U.S. changed them after Columbine. They were they're high school kids, right? 16, 15, 16-year-olds. They were well prepared. They actually, on a side note, they actually had a door left ajar at the back of the school. So when the police arrived, it was easy for them to gain access. The staff, the sergeant, the lead team of that team, the leader of that team, said, hold on, this doesn't look right. This is too easy. Luckily, because evidence showed that if they would have opened that door, one of these individuals was on a mezzanine. with their automatic weapons pointing at the door. So the police would have been ambushed. Okay, so that's how well planned they were. It doesn't open. Now we know it doesn't only happen at colleges, universities, or high schools. About a month ago, Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown killed 26 and 7-year-old children and 6 adults, injured another 2 after killing his own mother an hour or so before. This hit home for me. I have 2 young children, and about 2 years ago, I called the principal of my kids' school and said, what are you guys doing about lockdown and active shooter? And because my kids were coming home and saying, well, yeah, we practice, but what we practice are evacuations. So that's not what I wanted to hear. So I had, when I called the principal, yeah, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, and whatnot. Principal leaves. New principal comes in. Unfortunately, things fall on the wayside. After this, trust me, that morning, I called the principal and requested that if she doesn't move on this, that a parent-teacher assembly will be called, and I'll be calling it. Preparation is key, even at 5 years old. If people think it can happen to us, it can. I just showed you 3 slides in Montreal, and I'm not doing this to scare anyone, but I just showed you 3 slides of mass shootings at colleges or universities in the downtown core of Montreal. It doesn't only happen elsewhere. It doesn't only happen in North America. This is just one example. Sahari in Finland killed 10 at a vocational institute 4 years ago. Worst mass shooting incident in history, Virginia Tech, April 2007, Cho killed 32. I want to spend a few more slides on this because I want to get into a few different issues that occurred here. There's a new paradigm that Cho created in doing this. In the morning, early morning, there were 2 murders in a residence hall, Emily and Ryan. Campus police respond to this, responding to it. Evidence was showing, the information they were getting was ex-boyfriend killing ex-girlfriend, new boyfriend. So they were treating that as that. So campus police are going to the Emily's ex-boyfriend's house, interrogating him, figuring out it wasn't him. The reason why also they were interrogating him is the information they were getting from witnesses was the individual that ran away from the scene from behind looked like Emily's ex. So they followed normal protocol was to investigate further. In the meantime, while this was going on, Cho was doing other things. He had created a video manifesto, which while all this was going on, he had it delivered to MSNBC. In that video manifesto, it said, I have a record to beat. So we had never seen this before where diversion technique was utilized before the mass murder occurred. That 15-minute of fame slide that I mentioned to you a few slides back, there's no time to spare. In 9 minutes, killed 30, injured another 30, and committed suicide. Now remember, he killed 32. The first 2 was early in the morning. Next 30 was the mass murder. So before the police arrived, 6 minutes, he had killed 25 and injured 18. After police arrived, in 4 minutes, he killed another 5 and injured 12 and then committed suicide. There's no time to spare. The only way we cannot waste time is be prepared on and know what to do. You know that stage fright adage where, oh, I forgot what I had to say. You can't forget what you need to do because there is no time to spare. Still at Virginia Tech. We all deal with issues where we don't have enough personnel. You know, we're all doing a lot more with a lot less. 1,500 first responder personnel showed up at Virginia Tech at a certain time. Now, try to manage a major crime scene with 1,500 first responder personnel and everybody thinking they're in charge, right? Because there was local, there was campus police. there was the county police, then there were Virginia State Police, and then the feds showed up. So everybody wanted to be in charge, right? I had the opportunity to listen to a conference from Chief Flincham, which is the chief at Virginia Tech. And he had enough to deal with without having to, hey, who's bigger and who's more important type of style. He had to deal with that. 27 ambulances from 14 agencies. What were they doing? Securing the building, triaging the victims, evacuating survivors, IDing Cho. Who is this guy? They had to figure that out. Speak to witnesses. Investigate the possibility of other active shooters. Now remember, after this shooting, they're realizing, whoa, there was two shootings this morning. There's another 30 now. What's next? So all that was going on at the same time. Cho, there was multiple warning signs with him. He suffered from isolation. He was declared mentally ill in 2005, suffered from depression, had suicidal tendencies, had previous encounters with the police, and had behavioral problems. 12 months before the shooting, not a peep from him. Dean of students, no issues with him. Police, no issues with him. It's not as if he was acting up, and then he went on his rampage. For a year, there was no issues with him. Everything was great. That was the planning stage. Somebody had asked me why. Well, come on, he declared mentally ill. Why wasn't he medicated? As you know, we can't force medication. Why wasn't he put in a hospital? He was. He was let go after. Nobody's blaming anybody, but these are just the facts that came out of the investigation. The day after Virginia Tech, Collège Saint-Laurent, two teenage students walked into their school with paintball guns. Imagine this, the day after the worst shooting, mass casualty shooting, police get a call to respond to two people that are armed. Police response was immense, stress level was high. Thankfully, no one was hurt. They were interrogated, asked why were you doing this? The answer was, we thought it'd be funny. So even after Virginia Tech, people weren't taking this seriously. After Dawson, three teenagers planned a shooting at Green Bay East High School in Wisconsin. Preparation since 2003. Dawson happened in 06. Almost 3 years of preparation. Bombs, guns, and ammunition, radios were found in their possession. The only reason you don't know about this, they were reported by a classmate. Remember when I said, when in doubt, if you hear something, if people brag about something or say they're going to do something, report it? Imagine, a high school student told his dad when he got home that he was worried that something was going to happen because he heard that these guys were going to do something. So he risked being ostracized at school if this wouldn't have happened, as being a snitch, if you wish. Told his dad, dad calls the police, investigation happens, they find this, arrested these individuals. The day before they were going to act out their plan. Okay, so I'm going to show you a training program video. It's called Shots Fired on Campus When Lightning Strikes. It's presented by the Center of Personal Protection and Safety. It's a guide for surviving an active shooter situation. And I need to escape from here. If I could move with the mouse, I'd be great. That's not what I'm looking for.
I think this mouse is connected.
Is it? I thought it was connected there elsewhere. Thanks. Yeah, no, that's the presentation. I was right there. I just saw shots fired. Yeah.
Shots fired on campus.
Can you hear me?
Last thing you'd expect to hear.
Good.
The odds of being involved in a situation like this are similar to your chances of being struck by lightning. It's a strange thing about lightning, though. We use it as a way to describe something that seemingly has no chance of happening. But how many of us would stand next to a metal pole during a thunderstorm? I'm Randy Spivey, and I'm Jim Sporlier, both from the Center for Personal Protection and Safety. The possibility of being involved in an active shooter incident on campus may be remote, but the consequences can be catastrophic. That's why it makes good sense for you to spend some time thinking about what you would do if you found yourself in such a situation. It's a sad fact that shooting incidents do happen on college campuses. Because of that, there has been a dramatic increase in preventive measures, such as campus-wide violence prevention programs, efforts to identify troubled students, the development of threat management teams, and a major effort has gone into creating and upgrading notification systems and refining response strategies to get law enforcement on the scene faster. But even the best preventive systems can never be perfect. And let's be candid, if lightning does strike, if an active shooter enters your area on campus, it will be unlike any situation you have ever experienced. And in those initial heart-stopping moments, it will only involve you, other students and faculty, and the shooter. The bottom line is you'll need to take direct responsibility for your personal safety and security. You must develop a survival mindset. The purpose of this training is to help you do exactly that. With the proper mindset and the necessary tools, you'll be better equipped to react with purpose and maximize your chance of survival if you find yourself in a situation like this.
Survivors make a commitment. They take a personal stake in their own safety and security. They do whatever it takes, emotionally, mentally, to survive a critical incident. They ask themselves the what-if question. How would I get out? How would I survive? What would I do? Where would I go?
We know that these incidents are over in a matter of minutes. Most often, they're over before law enforcement is able to respond.
Your survival mindset is like a protective shield comprised of awareness, preparation, and rehearsal. Awareness involves taking the time necessary to gain a basic understanding of an active shooter situation. Preparation is asking yourself the what-if questions that will enable you to develop effective response strategies. The last component, rehearsal, is practicing your plan. Shots fired. Do you know what that sounds like? Unless you see the shooter, you may not recognize the sounds for what they are, gunshots. For most of us, our experience with gunshots is drawn from movies and television that use special sound effects. That means real gunshots can sound artificial. You can lose precious seconds as you slowly realize that these are, in fact, life-threatening sounds.
What was that?
That was a gunshot.
In a situation like this, most people, when they hear these types of sounds, having maybe never heard gunshots at all in real life, have really no idea what to expect. And it's not unusual for them to think that they're anything but gunshots.
I would treat any sound that you may perceive as a gunshot as that and act accordingly. Don't second guess it. Because when you second guess it, those seconds count.
Those are gunshots.
So what should you do in those precious first seconds? You'll need to figure out what's going on and make immediate decisions. How are you going to survive the situation? Will you get out? Is there a path of escape? Will you hide out? Is there a chance to get where the shooter might not find you? Or will you find yourself in a situation where the only option is to try to take out the shooter in whatever way you can?
These are serious decisions. That's why the survival mindset is so important to develop. Research shows that there's a real difference between reactions of people who've been trained to face stressful, life-threatening situations and those who have not. The first response is the same in both groups, startle, fear. But the reactions between the two begin to differ immediately after that. People who've gone through training, people like you, feel anxious, where the untrained and unprepared begin to feel panic. Trained people begin to recall what they've learned. The untrained fall into disbelief.
Are those gunshots?
At this point, the divide between the two starts to get wider.
I can't believe this is happening.
While the untrained are lost in denial, this can't be happening to me. The trained are preparing to act just as they've rehearsed. Finally, as the untrained descend into helplessness,
we gotta get out of here.
The trained commit to action based on a survival mindset.
Those are too close.
So that mindset is preparing yourself for the eventuality that it might happen, and that if it does happen, just tell yourself, I will survive.
A survival mindset enables you to act quickly and effectively. Let's go back to the foundation, awareness. When you get on a plane and the crew asks you to know the nearest exit, they're not trying to create fear. They're certainly not trying to make you afraid to fly. They're just trying to make you aware, providing information so you can develop the survival mindset for that situation. They know that if there is an emergency, getting you in a predetermined mindset will help you take rapid, effective actions in a stressful situation. They want you to be mindful, not fearful. If you're mindful, you'll be better able to make that first critical decision. Take a tip from the airlines. Like noting the emergency exits, it may only take a minute or two to look around your environment and make some mental notes about how you'd handle an active shooter situation.
You walk into your classroom, take a look at the exits, take a look at what is available if I had to hide behind it, if I had to use it as a buffer between an assailant and myself.
Well, it's important for students as they walk around their campus to ask the what if questions. What would they do if somebody came in with a gun and actively started shooting?
Think of all the contingencies. What are you going to do? Where are your escape routes? Where's the best access to call 911? Thinking about a situation before it actually develops is the best way to be prepared.
Looking at your environment through the lens of survival will help you to take decisive action more quickly. Of course, it's also important to be aware of the people on your campus as well. The fact is, there's no profile of an active shooter. And while we don't want you to walk around campus paranoid that everybody you meet could be a violent offender, we do want you to pay attention to the things that seem out of the ordinary. Accepting that a situation like this could happen is the first step toward decisive action.
So first, figure out the situation. What's going on? Where's it happening and who's doing it? Build your awareness using all your senses. Do it quickly and stay calm. Trust your intuition, your gut feeling. It's a built-in survival mechanism. Some people say it's knowing without knowing why, and it's an invaluable tool. For example, if you hear something that sounds like it might be a gunshot, assume that it is until you know otherwise. Once you figure out what's going on, you'll be better prepared to take action.
If you determine that you can get out to a safer area, then get out and get out fast. Don't wait for others to validate your decision and leave your belongings behind. The best way to survive an active shooter situation is not to be where he is and not to go where he can see you.
I'm on campus. I'm in Monroe Hall, and there's a guy here shooting people. And he's in a yellow hat.
When you get out, immediately call out to let authorities know what's going on. Do not assume someone else is calling.
If you have a cell phone, call 911 or use any campus emergency phone and be ready to give them useful information and be persistent as the phone lines may be jammed with other calls. Remember, no matter how good your school's mass emergency notification system is, they can't alert others until someone provides that first critical information. Calmly and quickly, tell them where you are and what's happening. In some cases, you may not be able to get out. The shooter may be between you and the only exit, or perhaps you would have to enter the area or the hallway the shooter is using. It might be safer for you to remain in place because you're well hidden and well protected. In any case, if you can't get out, then you must find a place to hide out. Find a place that will keep you hidden from the shooter's view and will provide some measure of protection should the shooter fire in your direction. If possible, avoid places that might trap you or restrict your options of movement. Once you've found your spot to hide out, you'll want to keep out the shooter. Hiding in a room that can be locked and that has plenty of things to hide behind is best. Blockade the door with heavy furniture, even if the door can be locked. If the shooter is nearby, though, just lock the door and get totally silent. Turn off any radios or other noise-producing objects in the room that might alert the shooter to your presence. And don't forget to silence that cell phone or pager if you have one. As soon as you have an opportunity, and without attracting the shooter's attention, call out to 911.
If there are two or more of you in the same place, do not huddle together for mutual protection or moral support. Spread out.
Those are too close. Spread out.
It's much easier for someone to shoot a group of people who are huddled in one place than if they are scattered around the room. Even if you're in a small room, spreading out will give you options and make it harder for the shooter if he does get into your hiding place. When spreading out in a room, quietly talk about what you'll do if the shooter enters. Whichever action you're taking, whether it's get out or hide out and keep out, you should help out where you can. Help others escape as you go. Help prevent others from entering the danger area. If someone near you has a life-threatening injury, if possible, provide first aid and keep them alive. Let others around you know what's happening and try to maintain calm and help them focus on survival. Keep in mind, as events unfold, you must continue to figure out what's happening so you can adjust your actions accordingly.
What if an incident begins while you're on your way to class or walking across campus? If someone starts shooting, stay in motion and find protection. It could be a tree. It could be a wall. Anything that will give you some protection while you figure out the situation and see if you need to do more.
Classrooms and lecture halls like this are unique to college campuses, and they've also been the location of prior critical incidents. What could you do if a shooter enters a place like this? There might be some opportunities to get out, either through other doors or perhaps a window. But realistically, people in the center of the classroom may not have the opportunity to get out. In that case, your only options might be to spread out, take cover, or take out the shooter. Unfortunately, you may find yourself in the same room as the shooter, maybe even face to face. You have to assume that his intentions are lethal to you, that his presence is a very real threat to your life. If a shooter has decided to shoot everyone he comes across, he'll probably succeed unless you stop.
If you can't hide out, and you have absolutely no other option, you may have to confront your assailant.
Convince yourself that you have what it takes to survive when your life is on the line. This is a life and death decision only you can make. It's so important to understand that in this kind of situation, anything you do or anything you don't do may involve life-threatening risk. If you determine there's no other option than to take out the shooter, then you must be prepared to do whatever is necessary to neutralize the threat.
Before the police get there, it's you against that bad guy, and you need to do everything you can to try to stop him, because you can't just sit and let him harm you or take your life or take your friend's life.
To do this, you'll need to become more aggressive than you ever thought possible. This means you either disrupt his actions or incapacitate him. Throwing things, yelling, using improvised weapons, can all be effective in this situation, but total commitment and absolute resolve are critical.
I'm going to throw this backpack, I'm going to throw this book at him. And then what are you going to do? Well, then we're going to gang up on him. How many are you in here? 140. How many of him? One.
If there are two or more of you, spread out, make a plan, and act as a team to overcome the shooter. Once again, you and the group will have to make a total commitment to your action and do absolutely whatever it takes without hesitation. To understand this better, think of the terrorist attacks on 9/11. Up until that day, the conventional wisdom about plane hijackings was that you should be calm, non-threatening, and wait for the plane to arrive at the hijacker's destination. Obviously, that guidance didn't apply to the hijackings that day. In fact, the passengers of United Flight 93 realized this and used a process like we're describing in this program to figure out what was happening. Once they figured out that the purpose of the hijacking was to kill as many people as possible, the passengers took decisive action to neutralize the threat and prevent further loss of life.
During my law enforcement career, I had the opportunity to talk to many people who survived critical incidents. And the commonality they shared was a single-mindedness of purpose to survive. No matter if they were physically injured, they were not going to stop. They were not just going to throw their hands up and quit. They were going to see it through.
You have to tell your mind that, you know what, I will survive. I will never give up. I will live.
There's another possible resolution to an active shooter situation, and that's when law enforcement arrives and takes action to end the shooting. When officers arrive, be prepared to calmly, quickly, and accurately tell them what they need to know. Location of the shooter, number of the shooters, if there's more than one, description of the shooter, and number and kind of weapons they have.
Police, where's the shooter?
I don't know.
What's he wearing?
He's got a black shirt and a yellow ball cap on.
Do not expect officers to assist you as you get out.
Okay, stay here.
Their first job is to stop the shooter and end the bloodshed. Law enforcement is trained to go to the sounds of the gunshots and eliminate the threat. If you're in a room and an emergency response team comes in, you must not present a threat to them. Do not point at them or the shooter. Do not scream or yell. Be quiet and compliant. Do exactly as they say. Remember, they have no way of knowing immediately whether you're one of the bad guys or not.
Police department, show me your hands!
The officers have been taught that hands kill, and they're trained to first look at people's hands. So raise your arms, spread your fingers, and show them your hands as you drop to the floor.
The first thing we need to do is make sure that you're not a threat yourself, so we need to see your hands.
They'll know immediately that you're not armed or aggressive. That will help them focus on anyone who is armed and prevent them from mistaking you for the bad guy in a very dangerous situation. Remember, they have to begin by assuming everyone is a threat.
Get out of the way! Get out of the way! Go!
Don't come running up to us. Don't do anything that we could perceive as threatening. Have your hands in plain view. Be as calm as possible. And then be prepared that we probably won't spend a whole lot of time talking to you because we have to go address the issue.
It's important for you to realize there are differences between an active shooter and a hostage-taking situation. The hostage-taker wants to use people as leverage to achieve a goal. This is very different than an active shooter, who is there to take lives. If you find yourself in a hostage situation, remain calm, follow directions, and wait for the authorities to resolve the situation.
In a hostage situation, you want to exercise patience, you want to be compliant, and you want to give the authorities a chance to reach a negotiated resolution.
Historically, the vast majority of hostage situations are resolved through negotiations and end peacefully. But if the situation changes and someone is actually walking around with a gun shooting people, you're in an active shooter situation. The focus of this program has been on surviving an active shooter situation. One of the most effective ways of dealing with this difficult problem is through effective prevention programs. Interestingly, the same survival mindset we've been talking about today can sometimes prevent a situation from becoming violent in the first place. There may be warning signs or behaviors of concern that something is wrong.
We do see pre-incident indicators. We do see some behaviors that might suggest the possibility of eventual violence. And many of these offenders oftentimes exhibit angry or argumentative behavior. They often blame others for their problems. They fail to take responsibility for their own actions. They're what we would call injustice collectors. They perceive every slight as a major issue that they have to take action upon.
If you're suspicious about something or you really have an uncomfortable feeling, far better to report those types of observations and feelings than to just disregard them and hope that they're going to go away. You have many options when it comes to passing this information on to someone who can act on it. You have your campus law enforcement agencies. You have your RAs. You have your professors. You have your counseling centers. Take advantage of one of those options If you wish to maintain your anonymity, there's ways to do that and still get the information to someone who can take some action on it and potentially prevent a tragedy.
It's okay to say something. There have been numerous shootings across the country that have been prevented by students knowing there's something wrong here.
We cannot do this by ourselves. This is a community, and in order to keep it safe, we need everybody's help, their eyes and their ears.
Hopefully, your college or university already has a violence prevention program in place that provides specific guidance on how to maintain a campus free from threats and violence. Remember, it's everyone's responsibility to keep the campus safe.
Shots fired on campus, a sound you hope to never hear. But if lightning does strike, you'll always have a weapon, a survival mindset. You can survive.
The most obvious that you don't see, right? Okay. So, what is an active shooter situation? It's a random or systematic act with the intent to harm others. The objective is mass murder. Possible weapons we discussed earlier, firearms, knives, explosives. Are we ready? We have 34,000 students or so, 8,000 employees or so, community of 42,000. My mic, sorry. Thank you. Apologize. So, just you being here today and out there in the rest of the libraries there, we're getting ready. The more people that attend sessions and prepare and plan in groups, that's how we can be ready. So, points to remember. When calling 911 from a cell phone, call us immediately after. So, we're at 398-3000, MAC campus 398-7777. When calling 911 from a landline, we monitor the call, so don't worry about that. Actually, one point that when you call 911 from the landline, we'll ask you, are you trying to reach 911? And the reason why is, in the past, we had a lot of missed dials, and it would go to 911. And obviously, 911 would contact us and say, what's going on? So we ask you, are you trying to reach 911? If you say yes, we hands off. If you say no, we hang up, because we have about a 2-3 second window to do this. So it's not because they're being impolite when they hang up on you, it's because they don't want the call to go further. Okay, but trust me, if they say yes, if you say yes, we're not asking you more questions. It's the 911 operator that's now talking to you. Okay? The only time we intervene, if you wish, is 911 operator might ask, what's your location? If you say McClellan Library, obviously the person doesn't know. Obviously not everybody knows every civic address either. That's when we would intervene and just say, give the address to the 911 operator during the conversation. That's the only thing we do. Know your surroundings. Know your staircases, the exits, where they lead to. Okay, we're creatures of habit, right? We come in the building, we leave the building, same door. We go out to lunch, through the same door. Go out for a little break through the same door. Know your building. Know where that door leads. What's behind that door? Know the building. Those seconds count. If you hesitate and you figure out that that's just a closet, that's a good thing. but it might be something else that you want to run to. I don't know where, you know, what does this lead to if I break this glass? Try to know where you're, about your surroundings. See, this is a huge place. You can't know everything, but use different doors when you go out to lunch, okay? Don't activate the fire alarm. Obviously, we're trained for fire evacuations, right? We do drills every year. So when we hear the fire alarm, we're trained to, okay, I got to get up, leave. If you pull that pull station, everybody's going to get up and leave. That creates a huge number of people in one location that will help the shooter in his quest to kill as many people as possible. It would also confuse individuals, because if they're hearing gunshots, they can't leave, and they're hiding out, and they hear a fire alarm. Shoot, what do? I'm hiding out because I think there are gunshots, and now I'm hearing a fire alarm. That could be confusing. Now, what are the chances that you're hearing gunshots and there's a fire at the same time? Could happen, but again, it's a judgment call. But it's for you to know that's why I state this. So you're not helping if you think you're running out, I'm going to pull a fire alarm so everybody runs out, you won't be helping. What you need to do is yell at everybody and say, get out. So just a little side note here. If you're involved in an active shooter situation, these actions are recommended. Note that these guidelines and recommendations may need to be altered depending on the dynamics of your situation or of the situation. So you need to take direct responsibility for your personal safety and security, and that's what you're doing here today. You need to develop that survival mindset we saw in the video. So survivors take whatever steps are necessary. So what is the survival mindset? It's awareness. Permits you to take rapid, effective actions. Permits you to be mindful, not fearful. Example, knowing your surroundings. So that you won't waste time if you know where that staircase leads to. Thinking of all the contingencies and asking yourself, what if? So if you walk into a room or into a classroom or in your area or wherever in another building, what if a shooter comes in here right now? What am I going to do? You need to know that because time counts. Preparation. So right now the awareness is what we're doing today. Preparation, right now we're doing some. You have homework to do. Preparation is bringing this back to your local area and practicing the rehearsal part. The easiest thing, next time you go for a coffee or for lunch, don't use that same door. That's one easy way of doing things. So in a matter of seconds, you'll have to figure out the best course of action, and you only can figure that out. Get out, can you safely escape? Hide out, spread out when hiding, this will give you options. Or take out, well, you need to take out the shooter. I can't tell you that you should be doing this, the taking out part. That's a personal decision that you and only you can take. Note though, that person is there to kill as many people as he can or she can in a matter of minutes. You know, we saw in the video throwing books, what is that going to do? The guy has an Uzi or whatever he has on him. It's distraction. The person's not expecting that. It could give you that 2 seconds that you need to do what you feel you need to do. Hiding out and spreading out. If you huddle all in one corner here, that's one target for the shooter. If you spread out, he can't shoot everybody at the same time. Gives you options. So if you're in a public or open space, hallway, cafeteria, library, and exiting the building is an immediate option, get out. The further you are from the situation, the better. Exit the building, notify anyone you encounter to get out. Call us, call 911, call us, provide the following information, your name, location, number of suspects, physical description, your current location. Okay, it might be tedious for you to, oh, come on, just get here. No, the information is required. Okay, so I speak quickly, clearly, and then the authorities will have the information they need. Exiting the building is not an immediate option due to the proximity of the suspect or for any other reason. Hide out. So enter the nearest room or office, close and lock the door if you can. Some of our doors lock from inside, some don't. If possible, barricade it with heavy articles. Cover the window if possible. I don't know if there's a window on that door or not. But some doors have windows. If you can, cover it up. Take shelter behind a sturdy piece of furniture. There's a picture right up here. Keep quiet and act as if there's no one in the room. Turn off the lights, any audio equipment. Do not answer the door to anyone. No, but police, trust me, they're not knocking in a situation like this. If they needed to get into a room, they're going to break it down. Or they'll have our keys. They're not going to knock. If a phone is available, quietly call 911. Okay, the same procedures. And then turn it back off. I just mentioned the taking out possibility. Convincing yourself you have what it takes to survive. You must do what it takes to neutralize the shooter. Tell yourself, I will survive. You only have that is the survival mindset. I need to live. I want to live. That's your only, you know, you might have a chair, you might have a phone, you might have a computer to throw at. But it's the willingness that will only get, that's the only thing that will get you through this. So continue with the taking out. If you're two or more, spread out, make a plan, act as a team, have total commitment. Do whatever is necessary. And like in the video, United Flight 93, when the individuals took over the terrorists on the plane and forced the plane down in the field, they died, but they saved the lives of others on the ground. Police response. They're there to enter the building, proceed to the area of the shooter quickly and directly. Their main goal is get to the shooter and end the bloodshed. They're not there to rescue. Okay, you might call out to them, I need help, I'm hurt, I'm injured. They're not there for that. Note, however, there's a rescue team being formed. But those responders, they need to get to that shooter. Remain calm, not to interfere with their operation. I know it's not, you know, it's pretty hard to tell somebody remain calm when there's a shooter two classrooms away or whatnot. But that's what they need to end this. Your commitment, put into practice what you learn. Knowing what to do is key. Pass on your knowledge to others. Take charge of your safety, and trust me, you're doing that right now. Report any suspicious behavior to security services, and then we'd follow up. My final words are be prepared. Trust your instincts and stay alive. So that ends my formal presentation. I don't know if there's time for questions. I'll let that up to you.
So. Are there any questions? If you could repeat the questions.
Okay.
So it's interesting. The fire analogy I thought was interesting because we're trained to evacuate buildings for fires. Now, the only responses we've been talking about is either individual safety or the safety of a collectivity group in a room where you're in contact. Now, we have libraries with multiple floors or even there one floor. What about the idea of trying to protect others beyond? What's the protocol? What's the best rules for if I want to make sure as much as I can other people around me, not just in my immediate vicinity, are safe?
Right.
What can I do? How should I think that one through?
Okay, so let me, hopefully I'm getting, okay. And if not, I think I'm just going to give the mic to the person with the question.
Yeah.
So the question is, this is great for personal safety, and I know now what I need to do, but what can I do to help a bigger group of individuals that are on my floor or in my area? Basically, passing on the knowledge, what you have right now is key. You'll be able to be the prof at the front of the desk saying, let's go, or let's go in this room. Let's hide out. Follow me, follow me. I went to the law faculty library staff a few months ago, and you know, there's ways of telling people. You have to figure out a way to convince students, because I'm sure we're talking obviously in a library, a lot of students, to follow you because you're telling them to do so. It's assertiveness. But it's you taking charge. And usually when individuals see that there's somebody in charge and in control, they'll follow. You being prepared, you'll be able to take that deep breath and do what needs to be done for that group of people. It could be getting them out. It could be hiding them out because you know the library so well that you know that that door is a huge closet. You could throw 30 people in there and they'll be safe. It's passing on that knowledge that you have to the groups that you're not necessarily responsible for, but you're dealing with at that certain time, particular time. I think that's what I'm going to do. Maybe I'll just pass. Yeah? Okay. So I don't have to repeat is what you're saying. Thank you. You could have told me that before the first. No. I'm kidding. Go ahead. Sorry.
Have doors that are on Linnell access that would open during a fire, but this location is actually a very interesting one because the most direct route from here out is through a door here that's on Linnell access, so that we wouldn't be able to get through, and this one we wouldn't be able to get through. There are three doors in the room next to us, but only one could let us out, and we would all be funneled into the same place. So what I am concerned about is, what about doors that are designed to open in fire and actually lead to a more direct route, but not open in such a situation?
Are there, is there card readers on here, or is that what you're saying? Like in this room specifically, or in other areas? Sorry.
Outside here, there are three doors.
Okay, that leads directly to.
And there's one that is the closest to an exit point, but that one is locked.
Okay.
So and I don't, you know, and that's just an example because this is my environment, so I'm very familiar with the doors.
Sure.
But. So there are situations in buildings, especially as we retrofit them, whatever, where we put Linnell access, which opens for fire purposes, but does not open for other kinds of.
Well, actually, there should be, and I'm looking at my colleagues in the back there. There should be a push bar on those doors. Yeah. So even if there's
normally going out,
not an issue. It's coming in. There shouldn't be an issue. Well, we could verify that definitely, because if you're bringing up situations that aren't safe for in that situation, we'll have to look at it. But usually, when there's a card reader, you could get out. Yes. No. Good. I'm glad to hear that. Well, but Bruno, he goes here and Chris is here, so.
Following the exit signs will lead you to emergency exits that are never locked. So following the exit signs is what you have to do.
Yes,
these exit doors leading to outside will never be locked.
Okay,
there are push bars outside. Linnell meters are not necessarily leading you to emergency exits that lead you outside.
Maybe they would lead you to safety. You know, maybe if the danger is here and this is the door that you could go through and you cannot.
It's knowing that.
But again, there's no doors that should be locked for you to get out. That doesn't exist here. That definitely doesn't exist here. But again, we could look at the area. If there's specific concerns that you have, we're definitely willing to come back and look at, okay, solutions. Go ahead, please.
Are you covering the campus in a methodical pattern in terms of your presentations, or is it just on a voluntary basis or invitation basis?
Just been both.
Until I got my email this morning, I had no idea I'd be listening to you today. It seems to me should be required attendance for all, everybody, especially staff.
I hear that all the time, and trust me, I am willing to do these as much as I need to. Unfortunately, not every department sees not the importance, but there's always something more important to do. We're very busy. Same thing with classrooms. I've asked for both profs to have some time in their classrooms. They can't afford it. They can't afford to give the time. So what we do is offer general sessions and respond to invitations from different groups to come and present this.
We're all here today, but we weren't really given understood that we should be here in terms of safety. That's what I'm saying.
Okay.
It was never highlighted to us as a staff, lower rank staff member.
As an obligation, if you wish to be here, as I don't know how is how the invitations were said. I'm just glad there's a huge turnout, because I'll be honest, I've done several public, you know, the more public ones where people sign up and we send, you know, through through What's New. You know, we send invitations and I have three or four people in a room, unfortunately.
Well, I work with a friend of mine.
Right.
Like many of my colleagues, but I'm one of the few in my department who are here because, you know, it wasn't impressed upon us that
Okay.
I wanted to be here.
Okay. Well, hopefully for next time, you now know that whoever wasn't here, you could stress the importance, sure. Definitely. I don't know who's next. Oh, Diane, do you want to respond to this? Sorry.
This is being streamed and archived, so all staff.
No,
not archived, sorry. And the reason why, I just want to, you know, somebody had asked me, why don't you just put it on the web? The effect isn't there, and secondly, there's no exchange. And the importance of this is the exchanging. You know, you could watch any presentation and, you know, do this, and do that. Okay, go home now. You're not exchanging. So I'd rather take time out of my schedule and, not that it's not a bit very busy one, but I'd rather do that, get a heads up of when this is going to happen, make a 1.5 hour hole in my schedule and come back. I don't know who's next. I apologize. I'm going to go here because I'm on the right, and then I'll go right to you and then to the left side of the...
I'm just wondering if your department is in the process of implementing drills, something like fire drills.
Right.
Those kind of drills, especially the library, being yeah. so big, on hostile drills.
Yeah. Good question.
We, 2 years ago, and it's no longer, Security Services responds. There's now a unit called Emergency Measures. It's been in place for about 2-3 years now. And they're responsible for preparation and planning. So what happened 2 years ago, it didn't involve staff or students because we did it on a weekend, I think, is we came here, actually at McClellan Library, and with the police and did an active shooter simulation exercise. For them to know our campus a little more and to know the libraries, for example. Are there plans to do active shooter simulations? There's discussion. I'm not sure where they're at, but emergency measures would be in a better position. I could follow up with them. I'm not asking you to do that, but I could follow up to see what the possibility is of running a simulation. There was some hesitation a couple years ago of doing it when students and staff members and faculty members were on campus, not to scare anybody, not to worry anybody. So what we did was, I think it was a Thanksgiving Monday, where we figured, you know, there would be, like, people would be gone for the, you know, the weekend, and so students wouldn't be necessarily studying over the weekend, so we wouldn't be disturbing their, you know, your operations. So I'd have to follow up to see if there's anything more physical, if you wish, of preparation. But I'll follow up with Claude. Good.
Sorry. How are you reaching the students?
I'm trying. I was at the law faculty, and a professor was in the presentation and came to see me at the end, saying, "I'd like you to come. I'm going to arrange that you come and talk to my students." And this was about 2 months ago. I gave a presentation to about 20 physics professors about 2 years ago. All gung ho. Call them back. We'll get back to you. That's the type of, unfortunately, tragedies occur. We're all ready to do things, and then we're all already falling off and saying we're too busy, we're doing other things. So I'm trying. We had sessions where it was sent to AUS, EUS, all the unit associations, the student associations. You know, how can we attract? Okay, well, provide cookies, provide juice, whatever. Stuff like that, and we try those things. Yeah, there you go. Actually, we did that 2 years ago at our Safety Week events on campus. That drew a lot of people. It is. But the offers are out there. Unfortunately, time is not always there for people to say, I'm going to give you an hour. I had the left side, but then I could come back here.
You're saying that you shouldn't pull the fire alarm?
Yes.
What if your only alternate exits are ones that are the fire exits?
Right. Then that don't happen. Well, actually, it'll be a local. The fire alarm won't go off. Yeah. The door will go off. The alarm on the door will go off.
Yeah.
But the general fire alarm of the building won't.
Okay. So, because in our situation, our only alternate exits are all the doors that are alarmed.
Right. That's fine.
So you're not evacuated.
That's fine.
Thank you.
Are you invited to the upcoming management forum?
I did a presentation 2 years ago at management forum. I don't know if somewhere you were there. I was there. I hit a great number of people. There was like 350, 400 managers, so I was there. It's not the most attractive, if you wish, or fun topic to talk about. So management forum was invited me out of a little push that I gave, but they were happy about it, but I'm not coming to this one. That's what I can say. I'm not on their agenda. Yes?
There seems to be a problem with sending questions online, so I'm getting it on my email. If this could be asked of the James Corner, it would be appreciated. When dialing 911 on the internal phone system, do we need to dial 9 to get an outside line before dialing 911, or will 911 immediately go to an outside line without dialing an extra 9?
Good question. Mentioned earlier, no difference. Quicker one is 911. But if you miss dial and you press 9 twice, it doesn't matter. Press 1 twice and it'll be 9911. So both are good. Yes?
Does it make sense to turn off the lights in the room?
Yes. Turn off lights, any audio equipment, stay quiet, and don't move is what hiding out is key. Yep. So wherever, I don't know where the light switch is right now, but I think it's right there. Whatever you can do, and hide out. There's pillars here. There's a few pillars in the room here. You know, put a desk around there. Put a desk. Although that door pushes outward, the person has to pull it. But if the door would push inward, obviously block it if you can, if you have the time to do so. If this was on the first floor, break the window. You have heavy tables. If you can, break the window, get out. Windows here. The shooters, if you're hearing gunshots and the person's banging, and if you know that there's no way that person could get in through that door in that office, use it. Maybe you know it leads to a staircase. Know your surroundings.
Well, just as a closing for this, I have to thank Peter and all of his group for coming. And communication, as a manager, communication is one of the most difficult things that I do, and I try very hard, we all try very hard, but sometimes we don't get the information out in the way that we need to. And so we will make sure that we invite Pierre back, and we probably had 110, 120 people from our organization watch this, but we will make sure that we have another opportunity very soon.
You're lucky, I'll be honest. This is the only time where I've been called back, because I did a presentation about a year ago. Trust me, I wish I had more invitations. You're lucky, because this is not the first time I talked to you.
Well,
I went to the law library. Library staff, I'm just telling you, you're in good hands.
I also want to volunteer the libraries to be a pilot of anything.
Okay.
Because we do have, there are so many students here, where we always have a little bit of everything in our environment, so we're always a good trial guinea pig for
good.
Anything.
Thank you.
On almost anything.
Thank
like
you.
That.
We
can
so,
go
on
then. Well, at least any practice that we can do with that. So, any other questions? Mom?
Well, I have a suggestion, because especially for the Magdalen Bethel complex,
great,
which is very used by students, that if it's possible to invest like some kind of metal detectors at each main entrance in case of, let's say, unforeseen events. So if somebody comes and is able to automatic weapon, so it should be detected before it is used.
There are so that's huge in terms of recommendation. The reason why is institutions of higher ed are open, right? And we want that feeling. We don't want to scare individuals in feeling that you're coming to a university now and you have to go through a metal detector. That's feelings that not only McGill has. There's not too many institutions that have metal detectors. And one of the reasons is we're open. Come and study, come and work. This is an open environment. We shouldn't have to go through metal detectors. Unfortunately, some schools have. Unfortunately, we need to think about those things.
That'd be a hard sell, not just a deal, because of that perception of we shouldn't feel like we're in a bubble and we need to work with better behavior. Not saying it's not a good idea, because a lot of elementary and high schools in the U.S. have them. But again, one building. A lot of those high schools are one building, one or two entrances. This is a Swiss cheese campus. There's entrances all over the place, right? So why are we securing the Cullen, for example, and we're not securing the Burnside Hall? So there's all that thought that needs to go into it. But you're not the first to bring this up, trust me. I don't think it'll happen. Not to say that it can't be recommended again, because other people have brought that up.
Anything else from
one?
I feel okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Here.
We have several things ahead of us, and we will try to get through this with alacrity, because I know that most of you probably are not used to spending this much time. We have about 20 minutes. So I'd like very quickly to ask Julie and Jen to come and talk about sustainability issues, and we're not going to wait. I don't know if you need PowerPoints or not. If you can get through them, up to them really quickly.
Yeah, well, Sabrina will bring up our stuff here. Basically, we are going to move away from these at our desk sides. We're going to change the way we deal with waste at our desk side in our staff work environments. We're moving to this situation. So you've got the blue bin paper recycling, which we're all pretty accustomed to, and this new little clip-on saddle for garbage. And we just ask that you take your glass, metal, plastic, all recyclables besides paper, to the centralized recycling bins in your staff area. Now, if you don't have a centralized bin right now, you will very soon. I guess why are we doing this? We want to change our behavior with regard to garbage. The size of your garbage can influences your behavior. This is well studied, well documented. Think about, you know, having a big plate at dinner. You're going to fill it up, right? So we want people to be more conscious of what they're throwing out. We want to reduce the amount of garbage that's going to waste that's going to the landfill. In many cases, this isn't actually garbage. So we want to intervene. The Ontario government is widely cited as the first North American organization to implement this program, and they had wild success. They wanted to cut their garbage by 50% in the first 5 years, and they did that well before the five-year mark, and in fact, they cut their garbage by 80 to 88%. This has been widely implemented in North America. Organizations typically find that they cut their garbage by 70 to 95%, which is a pretty staggering number. Audits of office waste typically show that 85 to 90% of office waste is, in fact, recyclable. So this just makes sense. And now the bins will reflect that reality. There's no need for this. This is really a relic from the past when we did not have recycling programs in offices. Okay. So in that sense, we're just modernizing our handling of waste. Also, the Ontario program that was so wildly successful and has been so copied was implemented in 1991. So that was a long time ago. This is the norm. We're going to join the 21st century on this one. And because we're doing this, we really are emerging as a model on campus. It isn't the norm on McGill campus yet. But we're going to do this. We're going to make it our norm. And we're already being held up as a model on campus because we are so many. And the Office of Sustainability and Facilities are already pointing to us, saying, hey, the library is doing this, and using us as an example for other units. So thanks for your cooperation with this. And Jen's got a bit more to talk about. Oh, I'm going to keep going. Oh, thanks, Jen. Okay. The other thing that the Sustainability Working Group has been working very hard on has been the signage for recycling. And we've been collaborating with, of course, we can't, you know, campuses are complicated. There's lots of responsibility. We've been collaborating with Campus and Space Planning and the Office of Sustainability and Buildings and Facilities to improve and standardize signage for recycling across our locations. We said, hey, we're just going to do it. And they said, oh, no, we've been meaning to do this for so long. So let's do it and use you guys as a pilot. So again, this is coming up, library as a good environment for pilots. And it is going to, again, lead to improvements across campus. The rest of the campus will follow. So what will it look like? What's going on? Apologies. So this is the current signage on bins. I don't know. It all looks like garbage to me. Jen, I feel like I have schizophrenia. So this is hated. People hate this. What is this? Where do I put what? It all looks like trash. So we're going to move to signage that falls in line with the provincial standards. And we do have provincial standards for recycling signage. And this is very close to what we'll be going with. The only addition is going to be the recycling sign, the arrows on the yellow and the blue. And previous to this, the glass, metal, and plastic stream has been green. The provincial standard is yellow. We're going to try and mimic your experience out in the world when you're on campus as well. So we're going to yellow for glass, metal, and plastic, black for garbage, and blue for all paper products. That includes cardboard, Post-its, office paper. Okay. Do we have another slide there? Okay. One very important point about the yellow stream, so that's plastic, metal, glass, and due to a lot of detective work by the Sustainability Working Group, we've discovered coffee cups, okay? The coffee cup and the lid, disposable coffee cups, can in fact go in that yellow stream. This involved, we opened up the recycling, well, we didn't, we had facilities open up the contract, and they do accept this, okay? So the signage will reflect that. We will see a coffee cup with the pictograms. And if you have any questions about what can go where, if something can be recycled, please contact me or Jen or any member of the Sustainability Working Group. Okay? Yes?
Supervisor Amber was mentioning a good idea. I thought in that. Is there a real need for each of us to have one of those bins at our desk, or could we just have a central one in our office?
For each of you to have one of these?
There's no real need for that, is there?
Maybe not. That's what we've done for now. We may move, you're right. I mean, we may be able to move to...
Really help out the cleaning staff too, if they didn't.
Yeah, this is, and that's a good point.
In each desk bin, you know, it doesn't...
Maybe it's unnecessary, especially in your environment, which is it's quite dense, the way the desks are laid out. So, I mean, that may be something that we do to improve it even further. You know, this is the initial launch. A lot of organizations, when they launch this, they do not have custodians coming around to the desks any longer. The philosophy is your waste, your responsibility, and you become responsible for emptying the bins at the centralized location. We're not doing that yet. This is we're starting conservatively, but we may get to that too. Okay. Does that answer your question?
No, I just
want definitely. I mean, room for improvement.
Seems like a good idea.
But it might even still be overkill. Yeah, I hear you. Yeah.
What about the plastic bag lining the garbage bin? You were mentioning that.
Yeah, we will probably see savings because we won't be lining garbage bins with plastic. We'll move away from that with this. And that's great, too, because plastic just goes into the
ocean.
Yeah, one more, Rebecca. I have two quick questions.
Yeah.
What about styrofoam coffee cups and number 6 plastic?
Those are not accepted, unfortunately.
So just paper.
Yeah. And
what about the lids? Because they're
lids
often
are okay.
Number 6.
Right? If number 6 is not, number 6 plastic, if you look at a plastic item, you see the recycling logo, and in the center, if you see a 6, this is... it's a special kind of plastic that's difficult to recycle and is not currently accepted, they can't recycle it, our people that handle the contract. So if you can have the presence of mind to not put it in there, that's best. Yes?
Is that six?
That's 6, yeah. And I used to think we could recycle those. You can't. The little tiny milk and creamers, okay? So sorry about that. And yes.
Is there one more? If there's no plastic bag in the garbage thing,
yep.
And people put food waste, are they going to get washed?
Yeah, good point. You can decide. Hey, I'm not going to put this apple core in here because it's going to be gross, and I'm going to go and just dispose of it in a central location. Or you can rinse it out in the bathroom. But yeah, we're moving away from having a lot of garbage at the desk, basically. Okay. Yes, these are being sold for scrap for repurposing, and we'll make money off of them.
Well, if in a building that has leaks, you might want to keep
them. They will find it back to your desks. Okay. Okay, single service point working group. If we have to rush too much through this, we will invite y'all back too, but let's go ahead and go. Okay. We've got a busy agenda. It's the beginning of the year.
All right. So I'm here to talk about the single service point working group. As you may recall, this was one of the working groups that came out of the library's new strategic plan. And our mandate was to implement or to develop plans to implement single service point across all of our branches, with our requests being triaged to librarians. So part of the reason why we moved towards this in this direction in the first place was because across research libraries, there really was a number of the in-person number of transactions was steadily declining. And as you know, more and more users take advantage of library services online. So additionally, our move to single service point makes our desk a lot user-friendlier to many of our patrons. No longer do they have to distinguish what kind of question do they have before approaching the desk. And so this was another of our motivations behind the move to this model. So the working group met probably about 12 times between March and December. And we came to that group with a lot of different varying situations. So part of what we started off doing was kind of gauging where everybody was at in regards to single service point, and then talking about what the best implementation would be sort of on an individual basis. And that was in regards sometimes to the physical layout and changes, but especially in regards to staff training. So that was part of what we were working on through the time that we were meeting. And it was really important for us as a group that we rely on each other for support in terms of best practices and, pooling our resources in terms of ideas and looking to each other for support as well. I'm really happy to report that our mandate has now been completed. And part of why I'm here today is just to kind of have a final wrap-up and share with you some of the recommendations that came out of this group, our final recommendations. Probably the primary recommendation that has come out is in regards to support and training. It's really crucial with the implementation of the single service point that training and support continue going forward. And this is really the responsibility of the head librarian. And this really needs to happen at a branch level. Another recommendation that came out is a kind of a consistency with signage. So a lot of our desks are currently labeled either borrowing or information. Now the move is, our recommendation is to move towards library services. And also to mirror our phone numbers and our email addresses in that single service point model as well. And we're also encouraging our liaison librarians to go forth and spread the word about this new model and let everyone know that this has happened. But we also want to encourage, of course, that the liaison librarians let everyone know all of the different ways that the library services can be accessed. We have a couple of outstanding recommendations, the first one of which is a listserv that we would like to have created, which will be happening soon. And the listserv is really just wanting to serve a kind of peer support network for people, for all of the staff working on the single service point or the library services desk. And we think this should be useful in terms of troubleshooting any issues that come along. And our second outstanding recommendation has to do with assessment. This is a really important point going forward. We're going to be working, Amber and I, and maybe another small group of people along with Lori, to figure out a plan for evaluation as we figure out how this model is working for us. Our third outstanding recommendation was a presentation at Dean's Corner. So as I'm speaking to you now, that recommendation is being completed. I have a very quick series of slides that just kind of gives you a really quick look at the desks, what the desks look like now. You'll see a lot of them actually look the same because in many of the cases for branches, it was a matter of changing staff scheduling and not a matter of a huge change to physical layout. Given that we're short for time, I'm going to fly through these slides a little faster than I thought. So we've got Mac, we've got law, we've got Islamic, we've got education. Here we are at Life Sciences and at Schulich. And here we are at Humanities and Social Sciences. I do want to take a moment to put out a big thank you to the members of the working group. I see a number of people here today. It was a really great group of people to work with. I have a special thank you for Amber, who co-chaired the committee with me. It was the first time that I chaired a committee, so it was a great experience for me as well. But the biggest thank you that we want to put out today is to the staff of the desks. All of the people who have been working really hard as we've moved towards this new model, the people who are actually working the library services desk, we want to say a big thank you to you. So thanks a lot. That was a little bit fast, but I'm done now and we'll move along.
We'll be addressing more of those recommendations at branch heads. Let's make sure that we get it on the agenda so that we finish them all up. I asked Lori to report on, I guess it's 2012's LibQual comments, and she'll just take over. I won't further ado. Let's just.
Okay, everybody. This works. All right, I'm going to try to be fast because this has been a long Dean's Corner. So I was asked I've already presented some of LibQual results last Dean's Corner. I gave you a lot of the results from the quantitative aspect of LibQual. And what you might already know if you've ever done LibQual or seen the results before is that there's also the more qualitative component of the survey, which is the comments section. The comments section is just a question at the end of the survey to invite people to give more comments. And this is the percentage of people that do so who are filling out the survey. So 45% of people who fill out all the quantitative questions also go on to give us comments. Some are one sentence long and some are very, very long comments. And they can be about all types of things. So this represents about 650 comments. We got 650 comments and I analyzed every single one of those comments to see what it was about. Half the respondents claimed that the Humanities and Social Sciences Library was their library of choice, so the one they used the most often. And half of the respondents were also undergraduate students, not necessarily the same half. The rest of them were either graduate students or faculty, and the students not using Humanities and Social Sciences Library, About 200 of those, so 300 used humanities and social sciences, 200 used either life sciences or Schulich, and another 100 used other branches as their primary library. So I just want to give you a quick overview of some of the findings. I will be writing reports that detail several of the issues that came up, and those will be made available. They'll be made available at branch heads, and if you want to have a look at them, you can. So today I just wanted to give you kind of an overview. Separating the comments out by undergraduate, graduate, and faculty. This is just a word cloud of the words that appeared most often for undergraduates in their comments. Obviously, library came up, but also issues such as study space, quiet space, and the McLennan building came up, things like that. For graduate students, space came up, but so did access to resources, journals, the catalog, articles, information, librarians. So similar things. And faculty talked less about the library as a space and more about access to journals and to librarians and to the collection as a whole. So for the real analysis, I tried to present something that's visually appealing to you so you wouldn't have to just look at a list of words or common themes. I divided up the analysis of the comments into the same categories that the survey is divided to. If you will recall, the survey is divided into three dimensions. Library as place, affective service, and information control. And so the comments can be grouped in similar themes. People brought up comments relating to the rest of the survey. And so they had many, many types of comments. And I can't go over every single thing that came out because there really is a diversity. But things I want to emphasize and things that were emphasized in the number of comments and in the passion in some of the comments, came out in certain areas, especially related to the library space, as well as things like the ambiance. That includes things like the noise level, the enforcement of quiet spaces or lack thereof, the furniture, the outlets available, and also the computers. Students expressed a lot of frustration how slow the computers were, how difficult it was, how many times they weren't computers that were broken, it took so long to fix, and stuff like that. This probably resonates with your experience of what students and users have said to you, so maybe it's not a surprise. When it comes to service, they brought up, most importantly, the missing books they couldn't find and how quickly they were replaced and the lack thereof, as well as issues with shelving and books lying on the floor for days on end or things like that. They were very frustrated about. They brought up interlibrary loan and document delivery, especially how much they wished that would be delivered electronically rather than in paper. And they also talked about the staff, and they talked about how much they liked the staff. That was a really positive aspect. When it comes to information control, this was an area that there were a lot of comments from faculty and graduate students. They emphasized that they really spent a lot of time using electronic resources. Faculty don't come to the library, and some of them made a point of saying, I don't come to the library, I just use it electronically. And they expressed some frustration in accessing things, understanding how to find out which journals we had, accessing ebooks and understanding how to use those platforms, which they found frustrating, and finding things through the website. They weren't sure where to look, things like that. They also expressed a concern, obviously, of always building the collection, or they expressed appreciation for our collection, how big it was. So I have some highlights on some of these scenes. So here are a couple of quotes from students. I wish there were more quiet areas that were properly heated. I think there should be more quiet places to study at the library, or at least someone monitoring the noise levels. Many are not shy to talk on their cell phones. So we know this really well. So students would like somehow for the quiet space to be enforced in some way. And they get frustrated when they hear students talking on their cell phones in what is supposed to be a quiet library area. And obviously, temperature is also an issue. There's also a couple quotes about the building, and these are kind of negative comments, but I also think they show how much the students care about the library. So this quote says, compared to the centerpiece libraries of other universities where I've worked and studied, Queens, NYU, Columbia, McLennan Redpath is small, drab, unimpressive. A great institution like McGill deserves a world-class library building. And I like that quote because I think it's negative, but at the same time, it shows that they really want the library to be nice. They want it to be nicer. They think we deserve something better, and I agree. So we have another one here. I generally avoid the downtown campus, choosing instead to spend my time reading and writing at the Grande Bibliothèque de Montréal, which I believe they mean Quebec. The lighting, air quality, comfort level, and general ambiance of the B&Q building make it a world-class facility. So they wish that McGill had a library like this. And these comments are really important for us to understand like what the students' expectations are and what they like about a library and why our physical space comes up short. With respect to computers, this can't be a surprise to you either. The computers take way too long to start. It's really not acceptable in 2012, McGill. The printers are out of service too often. It's a pity. We have such good resourceful libraries. It's worth spending a little more time to bring the technology to the level that students and staff deserve. So again, it's about meeting their expectations that they have for these things. More access to electronic books and further streamlining of online access to journals would be great. Continued expansion of access to online journals is necessary. So emphasis on our collections, especially journals. And last, I'm going to leave you with this comment. I'm graduating soon and just wanted to sincerely thank all help from McGill Library staff. McGill has one of the best library systems ever. Keep up the good work. So there were lots and lots of positive comments for staff. And this was just one example. So if anyone has any questions for me now or later about the comments analysis and how it was done and what the results are, feel free to get in touch. I'd be happy to give you lots more information.
Thank you. Thank you. That was really good. The comments are incredibly rich. And what you just saw presented there is takes hours and hours of content analysis work in Atlas TI. So to come up with the themes is really not a simple thing to do, and I'm very appreciative.
Thank you.
Now for facilities.
Yes, after those comments, we'll just briefly, I'll take 2 minutes, let you know what's happening currently. In the Life Sciences building, the second floor, the CyberMed, construction has started, and I'm sure our colleagues can attest to that. Demolition is underway. The project is expected to be completed in July of this year for us. So it's a very aggressive time frame. They are saying that demolition noise will be between 5 p.m. and 8 a.m. So hopefully that's true.
I guess we should warn people who stay from 5 to 10.
Yes. Yes, that would be good. Elevators to the second floor aren't available. The stairways are going to be cordoned off, or doorways into the stairwell. And we'll keep you posted on progress, and I look forward to hearing from Susan. And good. So that's underway. The education project continues to, we're finalizing the installation of additional seating, adding a group study zone, and more quiet seating. And we understand people like those areas to be completely separate. So this is what we're attempting to do in education. We're adding 58 new electrified desks in several areas, group study zone with whiteboards, and the shifting of the collection is underway. So once that's completed, photos for the next Dean's Corner. The McLennan Redpath Terrace, we're thrilled that the doorway to McLennan is now open. The right side of the stairwell will be open next week. We've heard your comments about lack of lighting. That's being resolved after the walkway was opened up. Please, we really appreciate any comments you send. If things aren't right, do send them through to Francisco or me. Phase two will be completed once the snow melts, so who knows when that will be. But and phase three will be the terrace in front of the Redpath Library entrance. So when phase three begins after convocation, that doorway will be closed. So we'll be back to one entrance. In the humanities and social sciences, we are putting extra seating in, and we're working with our students to source funding for expanding seating throughout the main floor in the cyber tech and possibly on the McLennan second floor. That's work underway. I won't elaborate, but I do want to give a very big thank you to Lonnie Weatherby and all the people working with Lonnie, Bojena, and others to migrate the reference collection either online, into the stacks, or very low-use materials will be moved down to the Redpath basement. Peter Martinek and his team are ensuring that collection moves, and once by the end of January, the stacks will come down, the reference stacks, and we will put temporary seating in that area. And a big thank you to everyone involved. It's a big job. Any questions? We're almost on time. This is incredible. Great. And if you have any questions, don't hesitate to just call or email.
Thank you again. We've had tons and tons and tons of content and information at this Dean's Corner. I think it's a record, so I appreciate your patience. Just a few closing issues, a reminder of upcoming events, Dean's office hours on February 5th and 12th, a coffee, Colleen's coffee will be, my coffee will be in Islamic studies. It's a very pretty library as opposed to some of the other comments we got. Don't forget that we've got a lundi gras party. Wear your masks, go shopping. And, Les Lectures d'une Humaniste on January 22nd, 7 p.m. at the BANQ. Recruitment, we're accepting applications for Head of Schulich until February 2nd. We have a documentation technician, Patrick Dupuy, was... Does everybody know what Patrick looks like? Stand up. Yeah. Wave. Okay. Congratulations. Management positions and collection services and the web group interviews will be held in the next 2 weeks. Head of Hustle, the posting period is closed, and we're moving on finding a – did I do that right?
Head of Schulich is closed, and Hustle, we're accepting the position until February 2nd.
Did people understand that? Head of Schulich is closed. We're accepting accepting applications still for Hustle until February the 2nd. I apologize for that. Senior Director Client Services and Senior Director Digital Initiatives, we're soliciting a search firm for. I also asked branch heads to give input solicit input from their staffs and for them to think specifically about what we really want in a head of a senior director of client services, because so many of you report up through that position. So thank you very much. And if we have to bring some of these talks back because we had to do them so quickly, we will be very happy to do that. Any questions very quickly here? Thank you very much. Oh.